Arnie Sherman.
You're listening to What Do You Know on News Talk KGVO, AM 1290 and 98.3 FM.
Arnie Sherman, it's a good Sunday morning.
Scott, I'm very excited that a longtime colleague of yours is going to join us on the show today, Rick Blywise. Tell us a little bit about Rick.
Well, of what I know about Rick, Rick and I worked together in the music industry in the 90s and the 00s, and he was one of my first bosses, Arnie, and just an incredibly creative, generous, supportive person.
Was he a good boss?
No, he was a great boss. I had several bosses when I worked in the division that he oversaw in the distribution company. And everybody who I worked for really took his lead in allowing you to be very creative and explore, you know, experimental in helping ideas and music artists find their audience. And it taught me a lot of valuable lessons that I still use to this day.
And that was early in your career. It was great that you had somebody as inspiring as that to help you shape your career.
Absolutely. Now he has followed a passion of his, which is writing. He's an author.
77 years old. He's turned out a well-reviewed, well-received, and a very interesting, concept. He's recreated, Elizabethan or later England, 1910, as I've read about it, and a very interesting named character, Pignon Scorbione, and the Barbershop Detectives. Already, it sounds like something you want to pay attention to and see what that's all about. So I'm anxious to hear about his career and how it led him at the age of 77 to start writing novels.
He's a fascinating guy because he's not afraid to take chances and not afraid to put himself out there. And look, he's created an incredible book published by Blackstone Publishing. The one thing I remember so vividly about Rick was his energy. And I think in this interview, if you don't get Rick with high energy, then something's wrong. He'll be high energy.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And thank you for thinking of him for our show.
100%. All right. Well, when we come back, our guest will be author and music industry a legend, Rick Blywise. Back after this. Arnie, we are back with our guest, author of Pignon Scorbione and the Barbershop Detectives, Rick Blywise.
Rick, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Thanks, Arnie. How about you?
I'm doing terrific. I'm excited about having a chance to chat with you today. We rarely get a Renaissance man like you on the show. Someone that's, author, journalist, rock musician way back, music industry exec, have recreated some of this nostalgic, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Agatha Christie, whodunit flavor with Pignon Scorbione and the Barbershop Detectives. And I guess my first question for you, you've had a long and storied career. Did you start out when you were younger writing and then moving into the music area? I mean, how do you describe yourself? What do you think of yourself looking back now? Are you a music person that writes, or a person that's an author and writer who migrated into the music industry and that took up a lot of your life?
Realistically, I would have to say my entire life, I was on a dual track.
That makes sense.
It wasn't one or the other. And to give you an example, on the music side, when I was probably about 8 or 9, I cajoled my parents into giving me guitar lessons. I mean, and when I say cajoled, I mean, I wanted to do rock and roll. They wanted me to do classic. Guitar was not exactly a classic instrument.
Right.
So, but I won.
Yeah, if you're not going to be a doctor, Rick, you're going to play the piano.
Right, exactly. So I started playing guitar very young. I got my first electric guitar when I was 12. I started playing in bands and writing music when I was 11 or 12, 13, somewhere in that era. But at the same time, when I was 12 years old, I wrote a sports newspaper that I made 4 carbon copies of and sold to my 4 closest neighbors. So And then I stayed in bands. I stayed writing music. I stayed performing music. And at the same time, I wrote a play when I was 15. I went to film school and I wrote film scripts to the student films that I was making. So I was, but at the same time, I was always in bands and recording and touring. So it was really always a dual track. And I kind of also, just to add something, I've also been good at business. So I think one of the things that my parents gave me, because they were the same way, was a very balanced left brain, right brain, because I was able to do both creative and what I'll call analytical or business. And it served me well over my career. And I enjoyed doing both. So it's not like I hate one and it brought the money in. I actually enjoyed doing all of it.
So for our listeners, as I'm talking with Rick, I'm looking behind him and seeing records on the wall. And it looks like in some cases, CDs. And so how did your music industry, executive kind of experience take hold? How did that unfold?
It started actually when I was in my first 3 years of undergrad, and I was at the University of Miami. I eventually transferred to NYU and got my film degree there. But I started at the University of Miami. While I was there, I saw an advertisement on the campus newspaper for an intern for Colpix Records. And this was pre the Monkees. I mean, they had a roster filled with crap. But so I answered the ad. I, like a number of other students, interviewed, and I got the job. And my job was to bring posters and other merchandise materials to the record stores in Miami. But I really had more aspirations than that. So I told them that I'd be willing, if they sent me records, to also go to radio stations to try to get the records played, because they had no regional or local promo man in the state of Florida at that point. Mm-hmm. And I ended up getting records played, mainly on their middle of the road station, because they would play anything anybody brought to them, because nobody ever brought them anything. So I keep phoning in to the home office, all these, right. I got this record on, I got that record on. Well, to make a long story short, they ended up giving me the entire state of Florida to promote with all of their records, R&B, pop. I visited every radio station that had a transmitter tower, and I became pretty good at it. So good that I was spending more time doing that than studying. And I was playing in bands at the same time too. Okay.
Any notable artists that we would know or remember?
No. Okay. The two biggest projects that I worked when I was there were Lanny Kazan and the Lord Jim soundtrack. That'll give you an idea of how bad it was.
You didn't even have question mark in the Mysterians, you know, or nobody like that. God.
96 tears.
It was pure,
96 tears. Pure. So let me ask you this. You've worked over your career with lots of well-known artists. You know, Scott mentioned this, Melissa Etheridge and Backstreet Boys and Whitney Houston and U2, Kiss, Bee Gees, some of the biggest names in the industry. As a musician, did any of these groups or did all of these, who starstruck you the most when you were working with them?
Wow. I guess I'd have to say David Bowie.
Yeah, I could see that. You know, I mean, the charisma around him, he's mythical even, in the early part of his career.
Yeah, although I'll tell you, Barry Gibb was a close second.
Really?
But I will also tell you that of all the artists I worked with, the one that I enjoyed the most, mm-hmm. I enjoyed him because he was like me, he wasn't just creative, he had an incredible, incredible marketing brain. And that was Gene Simmons of Kiss.
Right. He still has that brain. I've seen him, even now, saw him on Howard recently, and he's still active, and thinking and working through stuff.
Yeah, I remember the first album that I ever did the marketing plan for of theirs. It was in 79. I think it was Destroyer, if I'm not mistaken. was made for loving you on it.
Yeah.
And he and his manager, Bill LeCoin, asked me to put the marketing plan together. So I put a marketing plan together. I go to their offices and I sit down. Gene goes, "Do you have the marketing plan?" I go, "Yeah." He goes, "Listen, I kind of wrote one out too. Do you mind if we go through mine first?" And I went, "No, go ahead, go for it." I wrote a really good marketing plan. His was better.
Yeah, wow.
You know, and we became friends. We had some adventures together. And,
Rick, it's interesting. I'm curious, starting in college and then, through the 70s and 80s, you saw kind of the professional growth and maturity of the music industry. So what was that like? I mean, it really was transformative in a lot of ways, wasn't it?
Yes. And what transformed the music industry the most was major corporations buying the record companies from the individual entrepreneurs who had started them. Mm-hmm. In fact, Forbes magazine, for most of my career in the music industry, refused to call the music industry an industry. They thought it had no good business practices. It didn't deserve that classification. And they were right to some degree. What I saw happen was that some of the just fun, let's make it happen attitude went by the way of here are the corporate rules and regulations, and this is how we do things. Mm. And it made for better business, but it sure as hell made for less fun. Well, one of the things that I just read was an article which said that today's singer-songwriters and bands are having a tough go of it because more music that's being streamed, which is the way most music is being consumed these days, is old music. It's more than contemporary acts. And I think there's just an absolute thirst for nostalgia and for the old, not just the nostalgia for the sake of it, because it was just great music. And great personalities.
Rick, do you remember the first album you ever bought?
Okay. I remember the first thing I actually ever bought were two EPs, not LPs.
Right.
One was the Weavers at Carnegie Hall and the other was Huddy Ledbetter. The first single I ever bought in the quote unquote rock and roll era was a thing called Butterfly by Charlie Gracie that most people never even heard of. And I know one of the absolute earliest albums that I bought was a Chet Atkins album. And another was the very first Jerry Lee Lewis album. But that was maybe even a little later. I'm sure there were others. I know I had very early on Belafonte at Carnegie Hall too. My parents were really into world music. I mean, for people living in New York City suburbs at the time, wasn't typical, but they introduced me to Miriam Makeba and, people like that and the Weaver.
Sure. I remember having an early Belafonte album and Johnny Mathis's first album in 58 or 59, which was a great marketing thing, Greatest Hits. His first album was called Greatest Hits, which I thought was brilliant.
Yeah,
I think it stayed on the charts for like 10 years.
Yeah, I think it did. I remember singles more than I remember albums. I was a real singles buyer.
Some of our listeners won't even know what singles are. You just get the 45s and you were hoping there was something decent on the other side, right?
That's right.
When the Beatles came out, they kind of made the two sides work because their B-sides were always great songs to out of their chart. So
although I will tell you two records that come to mind way pre-Beatles where the A and the B-sides were absolutely both hits was Ritchie Valens, Donna and La Bamba.
Yeah.
And the other one, which you may or may not remember, was it was unique because it had two different artists on it. On one side, it had Buddy Knox doing Party Doll. And on the other side, it had Jimmy Bowen doing Bebop, I Love You, Baby. I'm sticking with you.
Well, my favorite A and B were John Sebastian had on one side. I think it was Hot Summer in the City. Yeah. And the other side was Darling Be Home Soon, which I always thought was a better cut than the A side of that album.
I loved both of them.
That was great. Let me go back to David Bowie. What was it about David Bowie when, you know, among the other artists that just made you say, wow, I'm in the presence of greatness?
Well, I got to work with him later in his career. So he was already a legend by the time I got to him. And right. When I met him, just the way his brain worked, the way he comported himself, you know, it was just, I don't know. I felt like I was in the presence of a special human being.
Right. And I was lucky enough to see him live a few times. He was, you know, one of the, even though they didn't call him that, I guess they did at some point, but he was a performance. When you saw him, it was more than just him singing and kibitzing with the audience. It was a whole experience.
Yes. Performance art.
Yeah. It was performance, you know, sort of like Laurie Anderson, who Scott has worked with and knows very well, sort of her way of conveying music, or the Talking Heads and their way of interacting with audiences.
Well, it's interesting because David Bowie was probably one of the first artists to really get on the whole digital transformation in the mid to late 90s. So there's a kinship with him and he and Gene Simmons. They were both kind of very forward thinking, which, Rick, yeah. I have to say, having worked for you and, you know, worked alongside of you over many years, that was one of the things that really distinguished your career, was just an ability to kind of see all the opportunities and kind of be able to, as you pointed out before, kind of just like go and do it. Like, let's go do it. Let's try that. Let's do that. And that's a very liberating kind of way of thinking in business that a lot of people are afraid to do these days. So how has that helped you kind of as you transitioned into becoming an author and a writer?
Well, Scott, you know, I have tried, as long as it's legal and it's not going to hurt me, I basically tried, you know, everything that came along during my life. It's, you know, like, as Wayne Gretzky said, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take, you know, which I like the quote, which he didn't say, even though it was attributed to him. You know, you can't score if you don't shoot. So, you know, my whole life, you know, I don't know if you know this, but I created a company called Your Name in Lights on Broadway. There was a big sign, the Spectacolor sign on the building where the apple drops.
Yeah.
And I did a licensing deal with them so that if you wanted to wish your wife happy birthday, I'd put happy birthday up there. You could either see it or we could take a picture of it and send you a poster. And, you know, I created the company. I did a licensing deal with Spectacolor, and it was an absolute abysmal failure. Sure. But you know what? The chase of the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, to me, that chase was always more exciting than finding the pot of gold.
Sure.
I found it and I didn't find it, but right. I loved the chase. And I just kind of feel that that's a great philosophy for people to live with, is take chances. If you know, try things, don't be locked into a box where, you know, everything is the way it's always been and that's the way it's going to be. I just don't believe in that. And look, I'm 77, a debut published author, and I hope I'm an example to other seniors that your life isn't over when you reach a certain age.
Absolutely right. I think we both agree on that. Before we talk about the book, I have one last question about your early part of your career. Was there an artist that you got involved with very early before they became a star that you just knew was going to make it and you had great satisfaction seeing their career unfold?
I would have to say that there were two in specific, and they were the two that I really had a hand in helping make. You know, I mean, I didn't do it alone. Nobody ever does it alone, if you will.
Sure.
But, you know, there are people who are more instrumental and less. I was more instrumental. But in both cases, I just saw the talent and I went, this is going to happen. And that was, well, actually, there are three. The first one was Melissa Etheridge.
Right.
The second one was the Backstreet Boys.
Right.
And the third one was Sarah McLachlan.
Yeah, well, all three of them, you can see the talent there. In fact, one of my favorite versions of the Bruce Springsteen song, you know, that he does with her is, you know, he, in almost all of his concerts, he, you know, he does Thunder Road.
Right.
And his version with her is the, is I think the gold standard of that song.
Yeah, it's quite
both different. Have the right voices, you know, to fit together.
Rick, it's interesting because you bring up those three artists and all three kind of broke pre kind of the America's Got Talent, American Idol kind of phenomenon that we actually participated in too through our company. But you and your colleagues were really the judges of, you know, what was good music and what deserved to kind of break through, right? Because you kind of you had access to the retail outlets when there were record stores.
Yeah, that's true. And it's kind of interesting because, I mean, for, you know, anybody that's out there who's listening, you know, it's really more the artists and repertoire, the A&R people who decided, you know, what would get signed along with, you know, the presidents and CEOs of the labels. So what my job and job of people like me was to take the artists that they believed in and make them happen to the best of our ability. So we did have a hand in that. The only artist actually where I would say, not I shouldn't say the only, but where I actually had an input in chasing or not chasing was Melissa, because I was hired by Island to be head of sales, and the GM handed me a stack of CDs on a Friday when I was hired and said, "You're gonna start work on Monday. I want you to listen to these over the weekend and come back on Monday and tell me which one or two you think we should be chasing, because there are more than this company can handle at this point." So I went home and I listened to them. I don't remember who the second one was, but the first one that I absolutely loved was Melissa Etheridge. So I go back on Monday and I tell Bill Berger, the guy who was the GM, I said to Bill, so Bill, he said, you know, what do you think? And I said, and I don't remember what the second one was. I said, but the one I really think we should go after is Melissa Etheridge. And Bill looked at me and he said, "Good man, I know why I hired you." Okay. I mean, that was obviously who he was hoping I would say, because that's who he believed in. But it was obvious to me when you heard, you know, similar features and "Bring Me Some Water." And, you know,
Let's do a quick ID. Our guest is Rick Blyweiss, author of Pinon Scorbian and the Barbershop Detectives and Music Industry. And he's holding for exactly. We only do audio, but still, it's a beautiful cover.
I held up the book, so it's got a blue cover.
Rick, one last thing before we leave the music. I also think you brought up the Backstreet Boys, and I distinctly remember being flown up to Montreal with you and with Pete and Barry and our whole group to see them at an ice rink, you know. In Canada on a wintry night. And Arnie, this is before they broke in the United States. Right. And they actually broke, correct me if I'm wrong, Rick, they broke in every other territory but the U.S. But well,
I'll give you the short story version of this.
Sure.
Okay? Jive Records came to me. And I'm not trying to toot my own horn. I'm just telling you what happened. Jive Records came to me. They had put out the first Backstreet Boys single in the U.S. and it stiffed. It did not do what they wanted it to do. But we all believed in this act. So they came to me and they said, "Rick, do you have any ideas of how we could break this band?" So we set up a meeting for the next week and I came in with two ideas. And the first idea I gave them was, let's forget the United States. Let's bring the boys to Europe. Let's make them conquering heroes over there. Their sound is very European in terms of the dance product they were putting out, et cetera. And then let's bring them back and have a ton of girls meet them at the airport like they did for the Beatles. Now, I was suggesting we even hire the girls if we need to. By the time we brought them here, we didn't need to hire them. They showed up. So that was the first thing we did. The second thing that I suggested was that we make Walmart Backstreet Boys headquarters, because at that point, Walmart was dabbling in music and they wanted to be better known for selling music. And so I just thought this would be a great way. So Scott, as a prelude to your seeing them up in Montreal or Canada, what happened was we went to Walmart and they said, we need to see them. We have to make sure they're clean enough for the Walmart image. So what we did was we flew their representatives to Switzerland to a concert at an ice skating rink in Switzerland as well, before the Montreal thing. And we filmed the concert. It was a Christmas concert. So they were like, you know, motherhood and apple pie with Santa Claus. And I had never witnessed anything like this in my life. I mean, they were pulling girls out of the crowd that had fainted. There were nurses stations. I mean, I could not believe what I was seeing. It was hysteria. I had never seen that before. So anyway, we go back. The representatives show the footage to Walmart and they go, all right, now we want to send our key executives to go see them. That was the trip to Canada. And that is when they agreed to become Backstreet Boys headquarters. And the rest, as they say, is history.
Fantastic
Amazing.
Story.
Amazing.
So Rick, grew up in New York. You've been living now for a good period of time in Ashland, Oregon.
Yeah.
You write a book that sort of takes place in a previous time and a previous place with a character, you know, like Pignon Scorpion. How did that all come to fruition?
Okay, well, as I said, I've kind of written my whole life. I've written newspaper articles and columns and magazine articles. And I've just always written, but almost all of it was nonfiction. I even contributed some chapters to some nonfiction anthologies on the music industry over the years. I moved to Ashland, ostensibly having retired from the music industry. And I got very, very bored. I had all this knowledge that I had accumulated, and I'm a type A personality. I just can't sit around. I'm not a bridge player. I'm not a golfer. I'm not a tennis player. I tend to do things more with my mind than my body, other than exercise. I joined boards of directors. I joined the board of directors of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, the Ashland Film Festival, the food bank, the university, whatever. And my next door neighbor, who I got to know, was a woman who was a poet. And we get to be friendly. And she said to me, so I'm in this writer's group. You've written, why don't you come? I think people would like you. I think you'd like the members of the group. Why don't you come and try it out? So I went and I started really liking the members of the group. And a number of them started writing short stories or were writing short stories. So I said, all right, I'm going to try my hand at writing fiction short story. And so I did. And they liked it. And I liked the process. And then I wrote another. And then on about the fourth story that I wrote, this is the way I write, by the way. I sit at a computer and I see whatever I'm going to write play out in my brain like a movie. And my job is literally to type it and capture for a reader what I'm seeing playing out in my head. I'm a pantser. I don't outline. I don't set anything up in advance. I just go with what I see playing. And this setting of a 1910 Downton Abbey-like English countryside, Hamlet, with a new police inspector, chief inspector, who's very Holmes Poirot-like, was just there in my brain. And I didn't have a name for him. I didn't have anything for him. And I just started writing the story. And then I did a little research and I fleshed out, researched into getting his name, his background. It just sort of came to me with the research I did. And I brought the story into the group. And the group said, this is wonderful. You can't just leave this as a short story. This needs to be a book. And I was writing two other books at the time. One was a sci-fi book and one was magical realism. Neither of those are ever going to see the light of day, and for good reason. But I ended up writing Scorpion, and it was with their encouragement and their assistance, you know, critiquing it in the early days, that made the whole thing possible.
How long did that process take? Because that's a major achievement.
I, on and off, I wrote the book over 5 years.
Wow. That is a long gestation period. Is that traditionally how long it takes? Or
Well, I just turned in the second book last week to my publisher, and that one took me under a year. So I have
got
two completely different experiences.
And is the second book a continuation of the same character?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So you have other exploits that Pignon is now going through in your mind.
Yeah, well, in the first book, you know, there's three crimes: a fortune seeker, a murder at a circus, and a crime of passion. In the second book, there are also three murders. There's a blacksmith who is murdered on his way home from birthing twin calves. There's a hot air balloonist who is shot and killed while alone in the balloon up in the air. And there is a client of one of the barbers who drops dead in his barber chair, and they're trying to figure out what killed him. I've already started the third book, and the third book has a magician in it who interacts with Houdini. So I'm all over the place.
Do you ever see?
I was going to say, so you've seen these in your mind. So the logical question is, do you see these as a movie at some point, or a TV, you know, series, or, you know, how do you see this playing out?
Well, I'm going to tell you something that is not common knowledge yet, because the press release is only going out tomorrow. But as of last Friday, the book was just optioned by a UK TV film production company.
Fantastic. Wow. Mazel tov, as we say. Congratulations.
That's in Montana, we say that. Absolutely. That's great, Rick.
Many a slip twits the cup and the lip, as they say. It's a hell of a start, let me tell you.
Well, get us that press release so we can include that, because this show airs on Sunday. So,
So when you visualize Pignon Scorbium, do you have an actor in mind? Is he connected to somebody?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I'll give you a roundabout answer and a firm answer both.
Right.
Scorbian's background, which again came to me, I didn't do this purposefully, it was just there, is his father was Egyptian and his mother was Haitian. So that could make him a man of virtually any skin tone.
Right.
Anything from, you know, pink to sallow to brown to whatever. So I've never done or asked for a picture of Scorbian to be done other than in silhouette, because I want the reader to picture who he is. I don't want to tell them who he is, because he could be so many different things. Now, to answer your question specifically, if this was many, many, many years ago in his youth, the actor I would have loved to seen play him is Omar Sharif.
Yes. And The one that came to my mind when you were describing him is Rami Malek.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, he has that kind of look where he could play many different kinds of characters, from Freddie Mercury to, you know, a James Bond, a killer.
Yeah.
You know, so
There are some really good actors today that, you know, I think could do a great job with him, again, spanning the gamut of what they look like.
So as you're writing, Scott and I have a great name for you for a character.
Yeah.
Particularly if you're doing if there's ever an American character in one of these books.
Yes.
The late developer of the area that we live in Montana, who was he owned a gas station in New Jersey, had one of the best names for a character I've ever come across in real life.
That's a heck of a setup. What is it?
His name was Buddy Seal.
Buddy Seals?
Seal. S-E-A-L-E. Buddy Seal.
Buddy Seal.
Just sounds like a guy, you know, who's on the lam, you know, or, you know, gets
witness protection.
Involved. Yeah, yeah. Witness protection program. Buddy Seal.
I like that.
He's no longer alive. You can use his name in any form or fashion.
Although it is so pretty close to Bobby Seale.
That's right. That's what I thought when he said that.
No, but Buddy, there's something about Buddy, the name Buddy, right? Buddy Hackett, Buddy Seal.
My very first friend when I was growing up was named Buddy.
Oh, there's a connection there.
Rick, do you ever see Pignon Scorbion interacting with the music industry or musicians, you know, your other world?
Because of the era, I doubt it. You know, okay. I mean, I wrote and recorded a Scorbion theme song that's in the audiobook and the video trailer. I mean, I have a home recording studio. I'm still recording. I don't know if you know, but I also had a video game created. There's a
really
no, I saw that.
Yeah, Pignon Scorbion Find the Hidden Objects game in both the Google and Apple app stores. And I'm pleased to say it's 5-star rated and it's free. I think because of the era.
Musicians in general, I guess, is the better way to look.
Yeah, actually, I postulated in the books, and even more so in the second book than the first book, that his real love of the arts is painting. And with Thelma Smith, who's, you know, becomes his girlfriend, if you will,
right,
books and literature. So it's more going to be books and painting than music. Although you never say never. You know, I got him with a magician, so maybe a musician too.
Well, think of all the great famous people back, you know, in that era, both, I don't know many in the UK, but readers in the United States would, you know a number of those people that were back, you know, Thomas Edison or Henry Ford or Mark Twain, Babe Ruth, were all people that, you know, were becoming known. William Randolph Hearst, you know, there's lots of possibilities.
I always ask this of writers. Is there a piece of yourself, Rick, in your own personality that is in the protagonist? Like, the nice thing is, this is somebody who you've created, but do you see yourself in Pignon in any way?
No, I don't. I mean, obviously, since he is a figment of my imagination, you know, I had to come up with everything he says and does. So there has to be some piece of me. But from what you're talking about, no, I actually bond more, I think, with Thelma Smith. You know, I guess the feminine side of me just, you know, I like strong, bright women and, you know, who are, and she, like, I hope I was most of my life, you know, was unconventional and didn't say it has to be this way because it was always right. This way. So I think I'm maybe more bond with her than I do anyone else in the book.
Sounds like Melissa Etheridge.
In a way. Absolutely.
So you write this book, you have this writing group that you're writing, you write this book. How'd you find the publisher? How did that all unfold?
Okay. I'm going to start by saying, for full transparency, I have been working as head of new business development for Blackstone Audio and Publishing since 2007. So I've been in the publishing industry for 15 years now. Okay, but what happened was, there are a number of agents that I've dealt with in my role at Blackstone, acquiring authors and manuscripts from them. And there were a number of them that I really liked. And I happened to mention to one of them that I'd written this book. I was still writing it, in fact, at the time. And I said, you know, I could use a beta reader other than my reading group because they're kind of like prejudiced towards me, you know, And so she said, oh, I'll read the book. And so I sent her the early manuscript, which wasn't anywhere even completed yet. And she came back to me and said, I love this. I want to represent you. And I said, great. Wow. And so she did. And then what she did when I finished it is she took it out to publishers and we had multiple offers on the book.
Wow.
And when she said to me, who do you want to go with? I said, well, I'd really like to go with Blackstone because I know the people there. I believe in the company. And, you know, I'd love it. And they did offer on it. And the president and CEO of the company, Josh Stanton, gave me an incredibly good offer and said he really wanted the book. The people there who read it, who reviewed it, raved about it. So I went, this to me is the perfect situation. We told the other companies no. And I ended up signing a multi-book deal with them. And in fact, I have another book coming out in May called Hotel California. And it is an anthology of mystery short stories. I have one story in there. There's a new Jack Reacher story in there.
Wow.
There's stories by Heather Graham, Amanda Flower, Reed Farrell Coleman, other huge names in mystery. And I've written a story in that. And it's a contemporary story about a New York City hitman who flees to Maui after a hit is put on his life. And it's the cat and mouse game between him and the hitman sent after him. Who's going to get who? And that's the first in a series of music and murder books. The next one is Thriller, and the next one is Back in Black after that. And
wow.
I've got a story in every one of them.
That's fantastic.
By the way, Rick is being modest, okay, just in the sense of his first book has a ton of five-star ratings in Amazon, over 80-plus ratings. And it's incredibly glowing, and I'm excited to read the book.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I'm really fortunate. I mean, the Pacific Northwest Booksellers Association had a conference last fall, and they voted the book their buzz book of the year. It's an Amazon editor's pick. It was a Barnes & Noble editor's pick. It's a Publisher's Weekly pick. I mean, I'm blown away by I really thought I wrote a fun book. I'm not even going to use the word a good book, because I didn't set out to write anything other than something that was going to entertain people. I am not Ernest Hemingway. That was not my goal, to be, you know, him or F. Scott Fitzgerald. I wanted to write a book. I'd rather write a Harry Potter book. And that's not
right.
In any way. I want people to be entertained. And with my book in particular, with Scorbion, because we're living in such stressful times right now, and this book is so unstressful, you know, there's no blood, there's no guts. It's an old classic throwback to a classic whodunit in a kinder, gentler time with fun characters and humor. I want people to be entertained. So I'm just blown away by the reception that it's been getting. I mean, it's so pleasing.
Well, it's a combination of all of these things that are coming together for you, you know, at a time in life where you really can, you know, add all of your experience to it. I mean, it is a time. I'm tired. Nobody wants to read a book from an alcoholic melodrama, you know, from the, you know, like the authors you had mentioned. They want something fun to take their mind off of things. I think that's primarily the reason why all of these Marvel comics and all of those sorts of things have taken hold of the movie industry, because people don't want to deal with reality.
I know.
Rick, what's the process? What's your writing process? Do you have a particular time of day that you get in front of the, do you do it in longhand? Do you do it on the PC? Like, what is your process?
Okay. First of all, I do it on the PC. You know, I do it on a Mac. I'm a Mac guy, but I type it out on a Mac. The only time I'll write anything in longhand is if I'm, and this happens, sitting at the dining room table and we're in the middle of a meal and an idea for a chapter or something comes to me, I've always got a scratch pad next to me and I will write down that. But other than that, no, I'm always at a computer writing. I don't have a set writing schedule. What I try to do, depending on what I'm writing, is I try to set a goal for myself of how many words I want to write either by a week or a month. I don't do it by the day. I don't put myself in a discipline of saying, I'm going to write 1,000 words today. Mm-hmm. I would rather say, I'm going to write 7,000 words by the end of this week and allow me to parse it out how I want to parse it out. Because I sometimes will sit down at 11 at night and start writing. Sometimes I'll write at 8 in the morning and sometimes I'll write at 3 in the afternoon. And it's really
when it comes to you. Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. Our guest is Rick Blyweiss, author. We'll be back after this. Arnie, we are back with our guest, Rick Blyweiss.
You know, Rick, you're a living embodiment of it's never too late to launch a whole new burgeoning career. You know, and you know, it's not just the first book. You have multiple books coming out, and you have, as you announced, there's going to be an option on doing a BBC or a British TV series that'll eventually, I'm sure, work its way over to the US. So how do people get a hold of you? How do they find you? How do they find out about your life, what you've written, what you're contemplating writing, where you're speaking, all that sort of thing?
Well, two ways. First of all, I have a website. It's rickbleiweis.com. And I think you'd have to put the, you know, tell people what the spelling of the name is.
B-L-E-I-W-E-I-S-S.
Right, rickbleiweis.com. And then I'm extremely active on social media. Twitter is Rick Bleiweis. LinkedIn is Rick Bleiweis. YouTube is Rick Bleiweis. Facebook and Instagram are Rick Bleiweis author. And so, you know, I can be there. And then I'm taking emails from the public with my email address createdbyrick@gmail.com.
So the email is createdbyrick@gmail.com.
Right.
You remind me of one of the other Wayne Gretzky quotes that you did use, which is he was fond of saying, when they asked him about why he was such a prolific, you know, scorer and the greatest of all time, he said, "I skated to where I thought the puck was going to be, not where it is."
Yeah.
In your career, you've looked to go places that other people haven't gone and take, you know, your work and the people that you represent and, you know, now your writings to a place that it hasn't been taken before. And I commend you on that. That's a fantastic way to live your life, Rick.
Well, thank you. It's just who I am, you know, so I wish I could take credit for, you know, going, oh, I thought this out and, you know, I had a master plan. I didn't. It's just how it happened.
And for our listeners who can't see Rick, he doesn't look a day over 40. So I think this whole thing about him being 77 is just sort of a myth.
You look great. Compliment, but you're a great liar.
Rick, you look fantastic. Will you join us again when you have the next book ready to roll?
I'd be happy to. I'd love to. In fact, if you have interest, I might even be able to get some of the authors that are joining me, you know, in the Hotel California book to do something if you wanted.
Oh, that'd be great. We would love that. We would love to. Arnie, Rick, thank you so much. Arnie, I will see you next week.
Thank you, Scott. Rick, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to What Do You Know?
I can't wait for the next show, Scott.
I'm excited too, Arnie. If you'd like to suggest a guest, send me an email at scottrichman@townsquaremedia.com. We'll see you next week. And thanks for listening to News Talk KGVO,